Welcome to Logistics with Purpose, presented by Vector Global Logistics in partnership with Supply Chain Now. We spotlight and celebrate organizations who are dedicated to creating a positive impact. Join us for this behind-the-scenes glimpse of the origin stories, change-making progress, and future plans of organizations who are actively making a difference. Our goal isn't just to entertain you, but to inspire you to go out and change the world. And now, here's today's episode of Logistics with Purpose.
Good day, and welcome once again to another episode of Logistics with Purpose. It is a pleasure to be here with you today. My name is Enrique Alvarez, and I have an amazing co-host with me, Christy. Christy, how are you doing? How's your week going?
It's good. We haven't done this together in a while, so I'm excited to be having another conversation with you and with one of our tremendous guests. It's fun to be here again with you. It's been a while.
I agree. It has been a while, and I think it has been a while for both. So we actually are both reconnecting, and we have an amazing guest today. Yeah. Before I jump into, or you jump into introducing him, anything good that has happened to you in the last couple of weeks? Anything interesting?
Well, yesterday, for those who are catching us on the recording, yesterday was July 4th. So it was nice to have a little bit of a break there. I am currently in Colorado Springs, so I was able to visit the World War II Aviation Museum and see a lot of restored planes, and most of which are so complicated I cannot repeat to you now all the facts, but they were super interesting to look at before we got a hailstorm.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time. And for everyone that's watching, this is going to be airing after 4th of July, but happy 4th of July to everyone.
That's right. Never too.
And now, without further ado, I guess, please introduce our guest of honor.
Yes, we are thrilled to have with us today Ronnie Alfassi, Deputy Director of ERU Operations and Preparedness at International Medical Corps, a tremendous organization, which Ronnie's going to share more about. I, for some reason, have lived under a rock and only heard about them about a year ago, so we are delighted to have more of Ronnie's firsthand experience and account with us. So, Ronnie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And before we get into sort of what you're doing now, which is a lot, we're going to cover a lot of ground. But first of all, we want to hear a little bit more about you personally. Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like? Tell us about those early years.
Yes. Well, I grew up thinking that I had a typical childhood, but then learned that that wasn't the case. So I was born in South Africa, near Johannesburg, and lived there for about 9 years, moving houses often as well, often in South Africa. And then we moved to Israel. I lived there until I was 16, and then we moved to Canada. So kind of lived all over the place, and for no specific reason. I think my parents just kind of like to move around. And so I got a lot of kind of international experience. My mom's from South Africa and my dad's from Morocco. So that added, you know, another element to it. And I've lived in Peru as well, which we can get into later, but that's kind of, my background is kind of an international mover.
Those are four very different cultures as well. So what were some of your big culture shifts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the big thing was for sure the language, like moving to Israel without speaking barely any Hebrew was a tough one. And so I remember my sister and I spending the first year at a center where the majority of your day is spent on kind of bringing you up to speed on the language skills. And I think we were there mostly with Russians, actually, that had moved to Israel. So we ended up learning some Russian as well. But yeah, so that was interesting and very different culture as well, kind of the more Middle Eastern. It has a warm nature to it, kind of like, you know, outspoken. And that, so that took a bit of time to learn. And then moved to Canada, which is very different. So I had to relearn my English. So sometimes I say English is my third language. That took a while, but then also Canada has a kind of a different culture to it as well. So yeah, it's been interesting.
Who do you cheer for in the World Cup or the Olympics? And it seems so many options, and Morocco is doing so great.
You know, we did once, my friends and I went to just different areas in Toronto that's where the home team was from. And we just went to the bar there and cheered for that team. And that was a lot of fun. So diplomatically.
Amazing. Yes. Amazing. So Ronnie, looking back to kind of those early years, any particular story, any particular memory that you can share with us that kind of shape who you are today and what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you grow up with a family that moves a lot, some people have the reaction of kind of wanting to stay put and not move and find stability. I think in my case, it was a bit of the opposite. I really enjoyed it, you know, learning about new cultures. And so I just kept traveling. And I think before my undergrad, I had traveled a lot in Latin America. And after undergrad, I actually went and spent about a year traveling in Southeast Asia and South Asia. And so I think that was kind of the first place living in India. I was in India for, I think, about 3 months. And that was the first place where I was really hit with like the shock of what kind of levels of poverty people are living in. And, you know, I went there as a traveler, as a tourist, kind of doing kind of the tourist thing, but I slowly got more interested in, you know, how could I help out? What kind of things that could we do in our lives to make the situation better? And so that was the first real time that I looked into this whole field of humanitarian relief and international development. I had volunteered in Calcutta with Mother Teresa's home for the dying and destitute, which is a very intense place to have your first volunteer experience. But I came out of that, and this was towards the end of my trip, kind of thinking like, okay, how can I use this for my life and for my career? And so I started looking into the different programs, and that's kind of what led me to pursue like further education in this field.
It sounds like a life-changing experience, right? I mean, what, just how old were you and what, again, how someone probably as young as you were when you decided to do that, mm-hmm. had the, I guess, the strength and courage to do it? Because again, it sounds strong, a great experience, but definitely life-changing as well.
Yeah. I mean, now I'm trying to remember how old I was. I think I was in my mid-20s, maybe early 20s. And it just didn't make sense to me that this could even, that this situation could even exist. And I think it helped a little bit that I went by myself. Now, I wasn't traveling in a big group. I was pretty flexible, so I could kind of look into different ways of volunteering. But also what that did was I was always having conversations with locals there. And so I would be sitting at a bench somewhere by myself and people would come talk to me, or what if I was on the train, people would approach me. I think that happens anyway in India, right. But being by yourself is definitely helps to kind of get that conversation going. So I think that was what made it, you know, possible to kind of do those things. And throughout my career, I've had these different moments of kind of gaining more clear understanding of the industry of international development and of humanitarian relief and what, you know, what things you can do that are actually helpful or might potentially be hurtful. And they kind of directed my career in that way. So the beginning was really like, how can I help all these people? Which is, I think, where a lot of people start. And then at some point throughout that career, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but it kind of started shifting towards the fact that this is a two-way street. I'm learning from them as much as, you know, I can help them from my end. And that was when I was living in Peru and really like gained a new understanding of how it works. And then eventually that kind of led to more of the humanitarian relief side, like, you know, what happens during an emergency response and how important that is to be the first, you know, kind of first boots on the ground thing.
Well, and I'm curious too, let's back up a couple of years for your academic experience. So that makes perfect sense how you got to the humanitarian side of things. You studied economics, you have a master's in economic development. So what were you originally planning to do? Because that's not a big pivot, but certainly a pivot.
Yeah, for sure. You know, originally, I applied to get into jazz college. I used to. Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, I used to play guitar, bass guitar. I was in bands. I really loved it. I was kind of obsessed with music. And I thought this is going to be my career. So, So I applied for Humber Jazz College in Toronto. And I didn't get in. I failed the audition because of the theory of reading notes and everything. I wasn't there. And so I couldn't decide what to do. The next best thing was, well, economics. That seems like a safe bet. I like numbers, so let's go with that. And it ended up being kind of a blessing in disguise, because what I learned from it was you know, studying micro and macroeconomics. So more the macro scale of things, like looking at countries in a big picture scale, was super interesting. I realized that I really like that. And then also stats, numbers, working with Excel, I really love that. And, you know, we did some courses where we were looking at developing countries and looking at different economic incentives or procedures or whatever, or policies that countries would implement and how they affect people. And so it kind of, it laid the background for me going into this international field. And then, yeah, and then after that trip in India, I was very excited to study international development. That seemed to me like the path forward for getting into this career. And I ended up getting into what's called the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs, which is based in Ottawa at Carleton and considered one of the top schools for international affairs, with a very clear goal for people that go there is to get into government work. It's the best path to get into it. And that is kind of what I did. So I wanted to study more of like the practical international development side, like working with organizations and everything. And, you know, you could, I did get some of that over there. And then right out of school was hired by Global Affairs Canada, which is the foreign aid department of Canada, kind of like USAID. And I realized pretty soon that this is not for me. I need to be in the field working. I need to see changes happening fast. You know, in the government, we were working in the economic policy department. So there's kind of like looking at different policy that you can do for developing countries or for low-income countries to help them kind of get out of poverty. But those things, those are high-level policies that take years to actually see an effect. And for someone, you know, eager to get out there at a young age, it just wasn't for me. And so I decided to leave and to go from there to work in kind of like a smaller grassroots NGO.
Wow. So, well, that takes us, that's a pretty good segue to what you're doing now. So talk a little bit about International Medical Corps. What is it and what is your role there?
Sure. So yeah, International Medical Corps, born in 1984 by volunteer doctors and nurses, actually in Afghanistan, where there was, I think a third of the population at the time were refugees that weren't able to access healthcare. And so these were passionate medical practitioners that wanted to provide healthcare services, but also train locals on how to provide healthcare services to multiply their effects. And so, you know, when I say healthcare services, we're looking at primary and emergency healthcare, but also other related services like mental health and psychosocial supports, nutrition services, nutrition assessments, water, sanitation, hygiene services, you know, prevention of gender-based violence is another big one that we focus on. So that's kind of how International Medical Corps started. Since then, since 1984, we've operated in just about 80 countries with a budget of about $4 billion over that time. So, you know, massive reach. We're currently in about 30 countries actively. And so, and what International Medical Corps kind of prides ourselves on is, so responding to emergencies and reaching those hard to reach places, the places that a lot of other organizations don't want to go or can't reach, that's what we do. So we're kind of first on the ground, first there, no matter where. That's what we kind of say about ourselves. Primary focus is saving lives. And then we look at how we can build longer term services. So some of the other things we look at is infectious diseases. So treating and preventing Ebola, cholera, COVID-19, we're very active. The end of that is really the training piece, which is how do we take people from humanitarian relief to self-reliance, and how do we give them the skills to provide that healthcare that, you know, that we're doing. And so that's International Medical Corps. My team, so I work in operations and emergency response. So my team, So International Medical Corps is a large organization, 30 countries, about 8,000 staff, most of whom are local to that country, right? So massive organization, but the emergency response unit is actually pretty small. There's about 20 of us, each kind of experts at a certain field. So you'll have someone really knows logistics, really knows procurement. You'll have people that, you know, on the health side of things, programs, finance, all of that. And so my team focuses on logistics, procurement, And so when I say logistics, I mean, warehouse management, freight, all of those kinds of things, and then operations. So we look at, we know what we want to do, and we're trying to figure out how to do it, how to do it the best way. And then I also oversee HR as a component of operations. And so every time we deploy to a different country, we need to figure out what that HR structure is.
Right.
So we have a team of four or five very, very gifted individuals in this team.
Yeah, there's a lot of logistics, right, going on for supplies and products, but also for humans, making sure that you can get there at wherever the emergency is quickly and efficiently and have boots on the ground as fast as possible.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you once again for everything you and the IMC does. And I wanted to point out that you helped IMC achieve the classification from the World Health Organization as an EMT Type 1. And so my first question is, what is that? And then the second is, well, congratulations for achieving it, because you are apparently, I think, one of the only NGOs in the world that has this classification for both categories, correct?
Yeah, the only non-government organization currently in the world to have both EMT type 1 fixed and mobile.
Wow. And for everyone that's listening to us or watching this on YouTube, so what could you tell us a bit more about what the EMT type 1 is and why it's so important? If you could tell us a bit more about how that kind of validates all those things that you and your team are doing.
Sure. And actually, you can see behind me, this is an EMT type 1 fix. This was actually at Texas A&M what we set up to get certified by the WHO. The idea behind this is it's a standardized approach for medical deployment. So, in the past and even nowadays, a lot of times when you deploy to emergency response, you'll have a lot of organizations doing different things, not coordinating well, and it becomes crucial when you're actually delivering medical aid to make sure that you have some standards there. And there's many reasons, but one of them is that you're working with the Ministry of Health, you're working with health professionals there. And so everyone kind of needs to be in line and understand what we're doing here. And so what the EMT is, it's a fast, self-sufficient health facility, basically. And the type one means that we provide outpatient healthcare. We're able to set up within 48 hours of getting an assignment from the WHO. We're able to set up and start treating patients.
Everywhere in the world, 48 hours?
Yeah. So, this is as soon as we get the assignment on the location, and this often comes in conjunction with the Ministry of Health and the WHO, then we can set this thing up and start treating patients. An EMT type 1 fix has the capacity to see 100 patients a day. And the type 1 mobile, which is similar to the fix, you have your base camp there, which is where you store your supplies, where people sleep, but you're sending mobile medical teams out to communities, out to hard to reach places. So oftentimes people can't reach you where you're at. And so that type 1 mobile has the capacity to see 50 patients a day. And so,
wow.
Yeah, the structure of it, looking at the fixed one, you have a triage, kind of like a waiting area and a triage. And then you have an emergency department fully equipped, then a few consultation rooms, which include maternal and child health programs that we can deliver. There's an isolation tent for anyone suspected to have any infectious diseases. We have a pharmacy there. There's a base camp for our staff and medical volunteers, a warehouse, an office, and then there's a lot of like water and sanitation and hygiene components to this. So there's water bladders that are, have clean water that come out to all of the tents. And there's also water taps where the community can come and drink the water from there. There's latrines, there's showers. So really—
Kitchen, I assume, as well?
There's a kitchen, yeah.
So it's basically like the whole hospital.
Yeah.
Basically.
Outpatient hospital. And we deploy with enough supplies to be self-sufficient for about 2 weeks, sometimes more. And then, we have standards on replenishment times, on how we track consumption and all of that. So it's a massive lift. A lot of logistics are involved in getting this thing out. We're proud to have this as one of our flagship programs.
It's remarkable. Yeah, really just amazing and how quickly you can organize. And some of the situations you're walking into are all over the place. So it's amazing what you can do so quickly and how you've risen to that challenge. It's incredible. You are, of course, as you just talked about, IMC is very well known in responding to emergencies. But you also, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you help make individuals in those communities. You take them from relief to self-reliance. So why is there's plenty of work to be done when you arrive, when you set up, when your boots on the ground. There's probably other organizations that could step in for the self-reliance part. Why? What does that look like? And why is that important to your work as well?
Mm-hmm. So I'll give you this EMT as an example. When we deploy, we're working with the Ministry of Health, and it's crucial for us that we work with local actors, so national NGOs, government actors, local communities, because oftentimes, you know, when we're gone, that leaves a gap. And we want to make sure that those services can continue and that they're up to par with those standards that we believe in. And so with the example of an EMT, we'll deploy and we'll start running the clinic with medical volunteers, doctors and nurses. But what we want to do is right away start hiring or working with Ministry of Health doctors and nurses or local clinic doctors and nurses and start handing over. And so that by the end of this, they are the ones running the EMT and they can take it forward once we leave. And so that's crucial for us. We know that when you train people and you multiply the effect that you can have. So we do, that's a big focus of ours is training. So, you know, we, in our programs, we're training thousands of people a year, and these are different trainings with on different levels, not just in primary healthcare, but also looking at mental health and psychosocial support. So we're providing psychological first aid training where when a disaster happens, locals are there, they can respond immediately. And if they have this training, they don't need to wait for us to come. We provide training in nutrition and water and sanitation hygiene. Logistics is another one that people, you know, might not think about, but, you know, we're working with locals, right? And so we're as we deploy, we're kind of working with them and building up their capacity to respond in terms of logistics. And so that really pays off in the long term if they have that capacity. Another example in emergency healthcare training. So right now we're working with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative to provide training in Ukraine. And so there we're providing training for healthcare providers on emergency and trauma care, mass casualty management. You know, these are often people that might not be used to responding through a disaster, but something has happened in their country. And so we're providing them the tools to respond in the future. And that's what I was saying, you know, we have close to 8,000 staff globally. A lot of those are locals that know the context, they know how to respond, and they've been trained.
Ronnie, quick question for you. So what was the last one, the last EMT that you guys set up, or the last couple?
So in Haiti, actually, there was an earthquake, August 2021. It was a 7.2 earthquake there.
Yeah,
over 2,000 people died. There were over 12,000 injured, and over 650,000 people were in need of assistance. And that shows you kind of the scale of what, you know, a disaster hits, how many people actually need assistance. It's massive. Another interesting thing is that when something happens, it's people think of a natural disaster, let's say, as a 1 month thing, but people need assistance way beyond that. You know, you have the people that are injured initially from the disaster, but then you have after effects of people not living, you know, people sleeping on the streets, there's infections, there's all kinds of things that come up. And then the recovery phase can last, you know, months, if not a year. So Haiti was the last time we actually deployed the EMT.
Wow. So if you could give us a couple of stories maybe that have impacted you personally, one of these maybe EMT setups or something that throughout your career with IMC, your very successful career with them, something that has personally touched you and just made you better or just reflect?
Yeah, so that response, keeping on that example with the Haiti response, just to give you an idea of I'll walk through some of the stats of what we were actually able to achieve. So we provided about 6,000 health consultations, 1,500 prevention of gender-based violence services, which includes over 600 mental health and psychosocial support, sessions. You know, people are coming to us, they have privacy, they have specialists that they're able to talk to. With our water sanitation hygiene, we provided over 65,000 liters of clean water to the community. We had 25 medical volunteers. There were over 30 staff that we deployed, which eventually transitioned over to local staff. Now, what that means logistically, that ENT had 140 pallets in it, mainly coming from our warehouse in Memphis, that we store our supplies with FedEx in Memphis that provide us with free storage. And FedEx is one of our biggest partners. And then we keep our pharmaceuticals with one of our vendors in the Netherlands that we have an agreement with. And so you're looking at, and then we have some supplies in LA at our headquarters. So you're kind of looking at, something happens, you need to get everything from all those places. So, you know, 140 pallets, it's about over 31 tons, 70,000 pounds. And that's massive. And so just in the US, we need a huge flatbed for all those kind of oversized pallets. And then five large dry vans, those 53-foot trucks that you see FedEx driving around in. And then FedEx actually provided us with a free charter plane. So now,
wow,
we're all getting ready to deploy, and you have to make that go, no-go decision, right? And that's always a big point for us. And so there's a lot of things at play there. One is, if we're not registered in country, we need either a local organization that we can work with as the consignee for the shipment. So that's a big bottleneck. If you don't have a consignee, nothing is moving, right? Some of our supplies are dangerous goods. So for dangerous goods, you can get them to the point of almost ready. You can package them correctly. You can label them mostly correctly. And then the last point of that is you need to fill out your shipper's declaration, which has to have a consignee on it. But if we don't know where we're deploying, then we always have to do that last minute. And so that's a tough one for us that we had to figure out. But we did it using a local team in Memphis that helps us out now whenever we have a response. And so then you get your supplies on a plane, and then I go out there to be on the tarmac when that plane lands to make sure that it's getting cleared. In this situation, because it was the EMT, we had the Ministry of Health and PAHO, which is WHO's Latin America and Caribbean wing, so the Pan American Health Organization. So they were the ones that worked with us to get the supplies in. So this is a UN organization, right? So you're getting expedited clearance, but it's still difficult, especially during a response where so much supplies are coming in and, you know, things are chaotic and everyone there just went through this emergency themselves. So people are kind of shooken as well. And with the earthquakes, you're having aftershocks all the time. So that was kind of that side. Then you get there, and so you got to clear the shipment and load it up. So that loaded up into about 8 trucks. And then we had to figure out, because of some security situations in the field, we couldn't just load the trucks up and take them all the way to our site. We had to kind of wait for World Food Program to help us with convoys to take those trucks. And because it was so much supplies, we had to divide that up into 2 different convoys and two different days. And so in the meantime, you need somewhere to store all this stuff. And you have cold chains. So some of our pharmaceuticals are stored in cold boxes. And so we have to get those out right away because it's really hot on the tarmac in Haiti. Make sure that we, you know, the cold chain didn't break, and then make sure that we're storing them in the right place. So, you know, massive lift. And so then they get to site and you have to set up. And that's our goal, is to set up within 24 to 48 hours. So this is 7 large tents. We're using about 30 daily workers that we found from the community, which is great because we're able to pay them a daily wage. And so they can take that home then. You know, we had about 8 generators, 5-ton HVAC units to make sure that our emergency department, our pharmacy are kept cold. So you're using a lot of fuel as well. We had to set up a fuel depot with 5 barrels of fuel when it's not easy to come by fuel in a disaster. And right. So all of those, you know, it's just really difficult. And then you have your team. So you need to find a place for them to stay. You need vehicles to get people around. So we had about 8 vehicles with 9 drivers that we had to figure out their schedule every day, who's going in which car. And, you know, the security. So everyone has VHF radios and we're communicating. And then, yeah, and so massive lift. But ultimately, you get this thing set up. And every day that I arrived at the EMT, 5 a.m., 6 a.m., there's a lineup of people that are waiting to be seen. And you just see the needs there are massive. And for me, I mean, you just see the payoff. Like, this is really needed. And we were there for 3 months. And every day we were seeing about 100 patients a day. We were at our capacity. And, you know, people were coming in. And we tried to see everyone. We would get to points where we couldn't. And so we would give them bracelets to make sure the next day they come, they're first in line. And towards the end of it, it's not people that are immediately affected by an injury from the earthquake, but they have knock-on effect. And I don't know if you've ever had the situation where you felt a little bit sick, but you went to see a doctor and you just walk out of there feeling better. And to me, I kind of think, I felt like that's the feeling that people were getting, that they were able to be seen by, you know, highly trained doctors and with people from their community, nurses and doctors from their community that right. understood them and understood their needs and were able to walk out of there feeling a lot better.
Yeah. Well, that's really amazing to hear the details that go into that. And I feel like it's an episode of 24 because it's all happening and you're like, how is this happening so quickly? It's only been an hour, been 24 hours. It's really remarkable. I'm curious, and you sound very passionate and excited about your work. So I have a couple of questions for you. One, there's a difference in talking about humanitarian aid where you're talking WASH, gender-based violence, some of those that are sort of long-term efforts versus these critical 48 hours, staying in Haiti for 3 months, this kind of thing that's all disaster response. So you could have, I guess, gone either way, and maybe you've done both, but what is it that makes you so excited about, like, this is a grueling effort. It's incredibly rewarding, but it's also a grueling, and just being wanting to be in the humanitarian sector, you could have just been somewhere where this is a long-term effort and every day is a little bit the same and that kind of thing versus what time is my alarm clock or alarm, you know, I'm going to go off today.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's one that a lot of people have, because a lot of people start in the international development world where you're working on long-term projects. So I started with a local NGO in Peru in the mountains where I lived there with them for 2 years working on these longer-term projects. Sometimes you start thinking like you're not 100% sure of is what you're doing having the best and the biggest effect on people, right? And there are many ways that you can mess that up. And I think that NGOs do sometimes mess that up when they're not careful enough to tailor their programs to the local context to make sure that you're understanding what people actually need and people want. So it's difficult. Those kinds of projects are difficult. And after I got back from Peru, I worked with another NGO called IDRF based in Toronto that actually funded some of these projects. We had a 3-year project in Zambia for prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, AIDS, really sensitive topic. A lot of programs that you can do to help that, but it's tough. And you have a 3-year project and you're trying to see, like, you know, are the results there? And through that NGO, there was in 2015, I believe, there was the earthquake in Nepal where we funded a local NGO in Canada, Global Medic, and to do this emergency response. And my kind of style was, you know, they would send me a proposal, I would review it, I would come back with a lot of questions because I want to make sure that what they're doing is the right thing. But in emergency response, it doesn't work like that. And so I did that. And the response that I got back was, why don't you just come with us and see what we do instead of us sitting down and trying to respond to all these questions? And I said, sure. So I went with them for 3 weeks and we responded to the earthquake there. And you know, they didn't see me as some kind of donor. I was one of them. I was staff and I was going out to the field and doing all these things. And there was a second earthquake, a very large one that happened while I was there, and many aftershocks at night. And so I was really in it, really got to see the needs. And there's no gray area here. People need help right away. And to me, I don't know, it kind of gave me this feeling that what I'm doing is the right thing. And then also, I think there is a little bit of adrenaline aspect to it. So people in our team, these are people that adrenaline kicks in and they go, go, go. And so you actually kind of have to learn how to stop working, because people will not stop and you'll work from morning to night, you'll get burnt out. And so, yeah, so that's kind of something that came later on and how to learn how to kind of pace yourself. But I think it's that clear mission that people need the aid that you're providing right away. And then also the adrenaline that kicks in that just because you see the work in front of you, what you're doing.
Wow, that's just incredible. And you guys are incredibly brave and courageous. And we can be more thankful for having people like you and your team in the world, because you definitely make a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the IMC has presence everywhere. You already established that. So Africa, America, Asia, Middle East, Europe, you name it. So how do you and your team stay prepared and maintain that readiness in terms of logistics and supplies? And I'll break it down in maybe two parts. One is, what are the top kind of news or parameters or just world news outlets out there that you keep an eye on? I mean, are you trying to somehow get ready before the disaster happens? Do you have like a couple of things already on your schedule that say, well, this isn't looking good, maybe a couple of months we will have to jump in here or there? Or is there some type of planning or forecasting that goes along? And then, of course, how do you get prepared and get ready mentally and physically from a logistics and supply standpoint too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it is very interesting because there are ways to prepare for emergencies. And something our senior director always says, that healthcare emergencies are predictable. And so there's a few different things that we do. One of them is we work with our different country missions around the world on something we call them emergency preparedness plans, where basically we look at what's called a hazard vulnerability index. So we're looking at typical disasters that could happen in their country. And then we look at the likelihood of that happening, the impact if it does happen. And we also develop kind of a calendar, because some diseases happen, you know, cyclical, and they happen very specifically in some months of the year. And so we kind of know that that's going to happen, and we want to be prepared for that. So that is how we plan. And so what comes out of that exercise is a focus on what supplies do they need to pre-position in their warehouse to be ready to respond? What training, what HR capacity do they need? So what kind of training can we provide to make sure that they're ready to respond? And we actually just went through this exercise with some of our country missions, and we saw with Central African Republic that we looked at what supplies they need in terms of medical response to an emergency, and we sent them over there, and then conflict broke out in Sudan. And now you're seeing an influx of refugees coming in, and the country mission actually needs it. They need to use those supplies to respond to an emergency. So, you know, it was probably a week after they received the supplies that they actually needed to use them. And so it kind of validated the point that, you know, this is really worthwhile, because a lot of these countries, for supplies to get there and to actually clear customs, they can take a while. Sometimes it can be stuck for months. And so until you get approval to kind of clear these items. Now, in an emergency, oftentimes if a country actually calls for international humanitarian assistance, they will expedite that process so you can get things in faster. But during kind of blue sky days, it's tough. And so we do a lot of planning with our different country missions. And then...
Well, it sounds like you guys get ready before, in this particular case, perfectly timed as well. So everyone had the supplies that they needed before they actually needed them by a week, may I add. So... That's great. I wasn't really aware that there was like so much forecasting and planning. So you're constantly shipping all over the world, depending on your models and what you think might happen when it comes to, I guess, hurricanes could be somewhat predictable, and some other fires. And
another example is hurricane season in the U.S. So we have a partnership with the District of Health of Florida. And so we actually start having meetings with them, kind of kickoff meetings right before hurricane season. And we look at our different our different kits and our different styles of responding. And we just make sure everyone's ready. We all know what we're going to do if something hits. Our team, everyone has go bags, you know, they're all ready to go with sleeping bags, mosquito nets, everything. So yeah, we make sure that we're ready. And our team, we just have an amazing team. Everyone is so talented. And you can deploy, sometimes we have small scale emergencies and we'll deploy one person out there, and you know you can rely on them to get everything going, to attend the UN cluster meetings, to make sure that they're coordinating with everyone, and to then kind of feedback into us and to tell us what is needed. And so we set up all these support systems. So for example, when we respond to emergencies, we have this kind of WhatsApp help desk group where there's a bunch of us sitting at home at headquarters and we're fielding information requests. So someone in the field is saying, can you guys look up where the shelters are in this area for this hurricane? And they don't have time to do that. So we are at home, we do the work, we send them the information and they can go on. So we have a lot of these different support systems set up to make sure people have the tools that they need.
Wow. Impressive. You've probably figured out a lot due to trial and error. I'm also wondering, so you've mentioned things that are actually a little more predictable, maybe like hurricane season, things like that. Then there's, of course, you know, one season is more, you know, I think this season is supposed to be actually be less active, but I don't know if that's going to end up being true. Fire seasons, we've seen a lot of that. So due to things like climate change, your work will only increase. I'm sure over the last few years, your response both to man-made and climate disasters have all the need has increased everywhere. And I'm continue to be surprised when we talk to people like you about disaster response and how small the teams are, how much you're doing and how much you tend to get done. And you have so much expertise to offer. So how would you like to see the disaster response space? How would you like to see it continue to evolve to meet the increasing needs?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing I would emphasize is that despite our emergency response unit being small, we have a large roster of people that at this point, I don't know where we're at, probably over 250 people on our roster in different positions that are ready to deploy. And so we have what we call an early warning system where we monitor every different kind of avenue that you can see it, that you can monitor for disaster response. And then something happens, if we have time, we will look at kind of an assessment criteria. Is this something worth responding to? Can we get there? Can we add value? And then as soon as when we do that, we issue a flash alert. And so everyone in our roster gets an alert that there might be a potential deployment, and then they can let us know if they're available or not. So right away, we know who we have and who's available. A lot of the people on our roster are actually part of our local country missions, which is great for us because they know the local context, and that is so valuable. And so I think the one thing that we are trying to work on more and more is establish partnerships with local NGOs because they're there on the ground and they're the fastest to respond. And actually, it can be a lot more efficient to basically kind of support them to do the work other than kind of like waiting for us to deploy in our supplies from the US. So that's one thing. So strengthening partnerships with local organizations is massive. The way that we develop kind of all of our country missions with local staff that know the context, that's another very helpful thing. But then we're also looking at other ways of deploying. You know, we want to look at kind of like the technological innovation that's going on in the world. So sometimes you can see in the humanitarian world that we're kind of like trailing behind, like catching up to the commercial technological world, even though our problem solving skills, I think, are really high up there because we have all kinds of situations that we have to deal with that, for example, with freight, that commercial freight forwarders aren't used to. And so we have to come up with solutions. And oftentimes we'll be deploying and these commercial freight forwarders will say, well, okay, we can't ship because of this. And that's never an acceptable answer to us. So we're always trying to find solutions. And so what I think is that these humanitarian NGOs need to kind of take that skill of problem solving and look at the technologies that are out there today and see how we can work together. And there's innovation. You know, there's companies like Flexport that are doing freight with the you know, that are, it's kind of like a tech company. You have your trackers and your dashboard, and we're working with them to actually display all of our shipments, even if it's not done through them, so that we have these trackers that automatically update us if anything's delayed. And there's companies like Zipline doing drone deliveries of blood and vaccines. And so there's a lot of companies that are kind of doing this massive innovation. And I think NGOs kind of need to look at ways to partner with them. Another thing that for a while now has been very popular is doing cash-based initiatives. So instead of bringing supplies in, which is heavy, costly, there's a carbon footprint, you're providing cash to people that need assistance. So you know, you have to make sure that the market is working, that they can actually get the supplies that they need, But if that exists, then cash is often the best way to respond. You're giving them the power to decide what they need. We're also looking at you know, solar initiatives. We're looking at how to make, is there a possibility that we can deploy this EMT and run it on solar power? Because oftentimes, not only is it good for the environment, but oftentimes, you know, you won't have fuel. And so it becomes kind of like risk mitigation. So these are some of the things that we're looking at.
That's very interesting. And of course, technology plays a big part in the world, and it does right now as well. So no, that's amazing. Again, once, thank you so much. Before we kind of wrap it up, Ronnie, and thank you once again to you and your entire team for what you do. In your own words, what does the phrase logistics with purpose mean?
Yeah.
To you?
I think sometimes, I remember when I was younger, I had this job, a summer job at a clothes factory. And I remember my boss had, I saw his business card and it said logistician. And I was so curious, like, what's a logistician? But it's such a vivid picture in my mind when I said to myself, that sounds pretty cool, whatever that is. And, but people have this kind of, I don't know, they have this picture in their mind of logistics is kind of boring. You know, you're like, I don't know, people are setting up an event. So you're booking a hotel room and getting catering and stuff like that. To me, logistics is just the most exciting thing ever. You're looking at your supplies, how to get them from A to B. I remember when we responded in the Bahamas to Hurricane Dorian, we had about 14 pallets of supplies that we needed to get them over to the island. And there was no way to get supplies over. And we ended up working with the US government to take them on to Black Hawk helicopter. I went on there with the supplies. I mean, some of these really cool moments in your career where you're doing these cool things. And to me, it's like I was saying that the team just, they won't stop working and you're just putting in these hours because you know with logistics that every hour you can be saving lives. Like if you get something moving, because there's roadblocks every step of the way, you get roadblocks. And so as soon as you solve one of those and you actually get supplies to where they need to be, it's really rewarding. And to me, that's kind of the purpose of it.
It's a great response. Yeah, I don't think anybody is going to listen to this interview and think, that guy's job is boring.
No, probably not.
Proven us wrong in that instance. Well, thank you again so much for your time. This was terrific. I learned a lot more about your organization, which was wonderful, and about what you do as well. So I'm curious, how can people connect with you? How can they support International Medical Corps? Tell us about any current needs.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. Really a pleasure to always to be able to speak about what we do. The best way to support us is through our website. So you can donate right there on our homepage. And the reason why it's so effective to do that is because that money allows us to respond to disasters that aren't in the media, that people aren't covering. Because when something is in the media, yes, you see an influx of money coming in, but there's so many disasters out there that aren't being covered. And there's donor fatigue and all of that. And so when people donate online, it allows us to kind of decide what we need to do and what would make the biggest impact. Other than that, I mentioned our roster. So any logistics professionals out there listening to us, just reach out to me. You can find me on LinkedIn, Ronnie Alfassi, and message me and let's get you on the roster and get you deployed.
Terrific.
Ronnie, thank you once again. And for everyone that's listening and or watching this episode, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Logistics with Purpose. I'm Enrique Alvarez. I had the pleasure of co-hosting with Christy Porter, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you so much.